The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Sri Master Dogen's Genjo Koan, Section 10. When a fish swims in the ocean, there's no limit to the water, no matter how far it swims. When a bird flies in the sky, there's no limit to the air, no matter how far it flies. However, no fish or bird has ever left its element since the beginning. If a bird leaves the air, it will die at once. If a fish leaves the water, it will die at once. Know then that water is life, air is life, life is the bird, and life is the fish. Now, if a bird or a fish tries to reach the limit of its element before moving in it, this bird or this fish will not find its way or its place. Attaining this place, one's daily life is the realization of ultimate reality. It is Genjo Koan. Attaining this way, one's daily life is the realization of ultimate reality. Since this place and this way are neither large nor small, neither self nor other, neither existing previously nor just arising now, they therefore exist thus. So if one practices and realizes the Buddha way, when one gains one Dharma, one penetrates one Dharma. When one encounters one action, one practices one action. So during this training period, we've been studying this teaching by Master Dogen, who was a 13th century Zen master in Japan, who, as I quoted from a scholar's writing early in the Ango, the beginning of the Ango, was little known in his time and did not portend great things because he was little known. He was not sort of in the dominant structures of Zen in Japan at that time. He had not done certain, he had not been an abbot of a big monastery in Japan, which would have brought him into prominence. He had been to China, which gave him a little bit of street credibility. And then he retreated deep into the mountains. But it was over time, centuries, in fact, that he became and has become one of the most well-known and prominent and important teachers within the Zen tradition. And so there's a body of, a collection of his talks that he gave called the Shobogenzo, from which this is drawn. This is one of the early, very early talks. And Genjo Koan is translated in various ways, but Mazumi Roshi translated as the way of everyday life. And the way here means a way, a path, as in the Eightfold Path, but it also means the true Dharma itself. It means your very body and mind. Every living thing, every inanimate object in the world is complete within itself. As Dogen says, it covers the ground upon which it stands. It is at peace within itself. It is self-organizing, we might say, self-intelligent. It, in and of itself, knows how to be in its world, from the beginning all the way through the middle and beyond the end. Human beings, because of our consciousness, our thoughts, our ability to create ideas and concepts, to imagine things that become real in our minds through mental images, we create a sense of boundedness. I talked about that on Friday evening, of an inside and an outside, of a definitive me and a definitive you. And yet there are glimpses we have. There are moments where we have glimpses of something else, something beyond that. A moment of wonder, a moment of awe, a moment of feeling of intimacy, a moment of sense of union. Looking out at a mountain or a sky, being in the presence of a river. We hear something, we feel something, we taste something, and something is touched, something is moved. We could try and explain it, often we do, but the explanation we know never, has never, and cannot reach the experience itself. What is that? We might think of it as a kind of a passing whisper of the way, of the Buddha way, the enlightened way. Something is being acknowledged, something is being touched. It's not an idea. You didn't plan for that moment. You can't contrive it. You can't keep it. We might think of it as an encounter or a glimpse through a window into what Buddhism speaks of as our basic nature, something that is unborn and undying. That's why it can't be contrived or manipulated or kept. You can't give it to somebody else. You could be standing right next to somebody looking at the same mountain, the same sunrise. They're not having that experience. We might think of this as a moment, kind of a glancing moment of being in our element. The fish in water, the bird in sky, what is our element? The Buddha realized this element, which is our basic nature, our true nature, our original mind, actually has no home, has no place, does not belong to time, and yet it is perfectly and completely present and appropriate in each time. And what can appear strange is it appears, the only way it appears is in form. And it takes innumerable, infinite forms. Anything you can see or touch, perceive, is one of those forms. When it appears within us, we speak of it as our Buddha nature. When the Buddha realized it, that was his liberation. When he realized that within him, which was his very nature, which had no home, no place, was free of time, and yet always appropriate. And that's why we chanted this morning to attach to things as illusion. To attach to things is want to hold on, to fix, to reify, to domesticate, to control, to harness, to put on a leash. Which is kind of what we're doing when we experience something and then we try to describe it. Right, we're trying to put it on a leash so we can carry it around and show it to our friends, right? It never quite works out. And so we practice and train in releasing, relinquishing our grasp at a fixed home, a place, a time, a characteristic, a something that we can solidify, reify, that's it, that's me, it's this. So you notice in the Heart Sutra this morning, everything and anything that we might say, it's this, it's me, is preceded by the word no. You can hold on to that if you want, but what you're holding on to is an idea of that. That will never satisfy. So an old teaching says, a painted cake will not fill your belly. But so, because we're so habituated to that clinging, we have to keep practicing. Relinquishing, releasing, letting things be as they are. To practice always means to practice as we, in a sense, practice into our homelessness, timelessness, which is really just the giving up the creation, the ongoing creation of trying to solidify and domesticate and harness and tether things. And so as we do that, we always practice in this time, this place, this awareness, this moment, the one true place, the one true thing. And to practice means to relieve our weary minds. It's one of the things we begin to see in practice is how tiring samsara is. It's exhausting. Oh my God, it's so tiring. Right? But we've become so accommodated to it. We are so accommodating of all of the ways in which we create our weariness, we don't notice it, right? But we do, and so we have to kind of dress it up and, you know, stimulate it and entertain it and whatnot. So finally, we're trying to relieve rest, true rest, our weary minds and bodies of our endless attempts to fix and hold on to name, to know. It's like trying to domesticate the autumn breeze or to add meaning to all the changing colors. What does it mean? This one's red, this one's yellow. What does that mean? Or maybe we want the autumn to move faster so we can get on the ski slopes. Or maybe we don't want it to happen at all and just be summer all the time. I want this. I don't want that. But finally, when we relinquish, we can rest and be happy. We think we can do that when we finally become the master controller, right? When we've finally figured out how to make everybody cooperate and do what we need and want, right? Of course, the larger world is constantly thwarting that, right? Messing up our plans. No one has ever found true happiness this way. So Dogen says, if a bird or fish tries to reach the limit of its element before moving in it, it will not find its way. It will not find its place. And so what he's saying is, first we have to learn to move in our element as practitioners. And so one of the first things that happens every time someone comes here on a Sunday morning for an introductory retreat, we say hello, we give you a little bit of food maybe, and then you learn how to sit zazen. You sit down, you're given this most incredible, powerful, in a sense, transmission of teaching that has come directly from the Buddha, that has been maintained through the bodies and minds of practitioners who they themselves had to learn and practice since the time of the Buddha. And we sit down and we face this self that we believe in, trust in, or trying to maintain and protect, that we don't want to lose. And we begin to gain trust that we can relieve ourselves of this burden. We can let it down. We can free ourselves of the exhausting practice of judging, of constantly trying to succeed and not fail. But success, in a way, is just setting up the next failure because you're only as good as your last meal if you're a cook. You're only as good as your last book if you're an author. And the better it is, the greater the risk, right? Now what? And so to finally try and free ourselves, to study the way Dogen said, is to study the self, to discover our great capacity for facing what most of us don't want to face, right? I mean, I've watched people come here from all different walks of life who've done incredibly difficult things in their life. Mentally difficult, intellectually difficult, athletically, Navy SEALs, people who've been in combat, people who faced, you know, great risk. There's something about sitting on that simple black mat that can bring even a great warrior to their knees. It's a different kind of risk. It's a different kind of courage. Mizumi Roshi said, quoting an old Zen master said, who said, inwardly see yourself nature and be unshakable, indestructible. This is the Zen tradition. And then he comments, says, mere physical sitting is not enough. You have to sit carefully and attentively. Let your body sit. Let your mind sit. Let your emotions sit. Let your breathing sit. Let your blood circulation sit. Let everything sit. Then your sitting becomes indestructible, immovable. And when you really enter into it, it becomes more than that. It's the entire world in the 10 directions becomes a bright jewel. There's nothing to move and nothing to be moved, nothing to destroy, nothing to be destroyed. This is Zazen. Letting everything sit is letting everything be in its own way. Begin to enter into its element. Trying to reach the limit of the element before moving around in it, I thought of, you know, it's like the image of the child who's dressing up in mommy or daddy's clothes, right? So they can be a grown-up. Trying to put on equanimity or put on patience or put on enlightenment, right? It's not real. I saw somebody in Doksan many years ago who came in and talked about his glorious enlightenment experience and then quite curiously went on to talk about his life, which was a complete train wreck. And there seemed to be no question in his mind about these two seemingly very different experiences. seemingly because it raised the question of what is he calling this enlightenment experience? If we try to enlighten our mind or be selflessly compassionate before moving in our element, Dogen says we will not find our way or place. And so we have to do the thing that often is the last thing we want to do, which is just actually face ourselves. Not the person, the self we want, that we want everybody else to see, that we should be, but just what appears. That's why it's so important to sit without an agenda. So everybody comes to the seat with a practice. That's your practice. That's what we turn our attention to. And then whatever is arising, whatever karmic energies, whatever actions, whatever is ripe will appear. And that's the moment. It has appeared because that is the moment to face it. And that is the moment of opportunity to see, to understand, to relinquish, to become less weary. Mazumi says, in the case of Mazumi Roshi was Dada Roshi's teacher, primary teacher, and Dada Roshi was our teacher, my teacher, the teacher of some of us in the room. Ours, that doesn't work. In the case of the bird and fish, it's obvious that wherever they are, that's their place. And wherever they go, that's their way. Some birds, for example, migrate back to the same place year after year. No matter whether we call it unconscious or instinctive, that's their way. Call it what you like, that's their way. We also have our way, which we call the supreme way, the Buddha way. That is to say, when we do one thing, we are complete in that moment. The way is right here, wherever we are. When we realize that this is the place, and we are the way, then practice naturally follows, spontaneously, and that practice is Genjo Koan, is realization of ultimate reality, is the way of everyday life. And so clearly the practice is, how do we turn our attention to this moment and be complete in that moment? I talked on Friday about all the forms of practice to bring us closer, intimacy, and how there seems to be this ongoing sense in human beings throughout time and place of being somehow having lost our element, that place, being estranged, outside of, apart from something essential that is the cause of our dis-ease, and if we can find our way back. And then what the Buddha realized is we have never lost our way. Losing our way is what we call delusion, the sense of that. And so we have to trust more than we might imagine and actually explore over time, what is that? What is that? What is it to trust deeply? And to not deny, to not cling the reality before us. What is it to trust this moment, whatever, however it's arising, whether it's affirming life or destroying it, whether it's good or bad, whether we like it or not? What does it mean to trust that? How is that an entry point? Not trusting is basically saying and embodying, I am not complete in this moment. This moment is not complete. This moment needs a little bit of work. It needs more of this or less of that. It needs me to control it or control it better. And so Dogen says, attaining this place, one's daily life is the realization of ultimate reality. Attaining this way, one's daily life is the realization of ultimate reality. Realization is the direct experience. And this is Genjo Koan. Attaining this place, then our daily life becomes the way. When we begin to gain that trust, this faith, then the struggle begins to soften, even when it's difficult. There's difficulty, but it's not the struggle. That's what we're relinquishing. We tend to think, if we don't struggle, then how are we going to win this battle? Well, let's start with, it's not a battle. That does not have to be the paradigm for everything. And when it's not a battle, what is it? The struggle begins to soften. The weariness gives way to aliveness. It's one of the reasons we practice with rigor, right? Is it actually does stretch us. It stretches us to what we think of as our physical limits, or our mental limits, or our emotional limits. Why? So that we can come up close to that sense of limitation. And the sense that the way that to deal with this is more sleep, more coffee, less of this, more of that. But what you're faced with in that moment is just you. That's what you got to work with, just you. Because the Buddha realized that's what you need. That's the thing that's complete. But we have to find that within ourselves. Well, we are mothers of invention, aren't we? Right? We find what we need in the moments when we need it. If we trust. If we turn back into the practice, what was that instruction? What did they say when I face pain, tiredness? Those are the questions people bring in the Dokusan, rightly. How do I practice this? Fear begins to shift to courage. Hope gives way to verification. Irritation to patience. Stinginess to generosity. We begin to see and experience that our life, as it is, and must be, because it's the life we got. You don't get an alternative life, right? At any point along the way, did God or some cosmic force come and say, how's this working for you? I can give you another one if you want, right? Or I gave you the wrong one by mistake, right? I meant to give you this one, but I gave you this one. Let's switch up. That doesn't happen. We get the one we've got. So if there's going to be a path, it has to be in the life we have. And we begin to see, oh, that is the life. And in many ways, it's the perfect life. And in many ways, it's the perfect life because of the difficulties in it. And that's not poetry, although we can write poetry about it. It's because we are learning how to liberate ourselves from turning that into a struggle. Dogen says, since this place and this way are neither large nor small, self nor other, existing previously or arising now, they exist thus. When we stop comparing and judging, naming and labeling, solidifying, knowing it is this, it is that, what's left? So an old koan says, if you call this a stick, then you're attached to the name. If you deny it's a stick because you say it's empty of any inherent existence, then you deny its existence. So if you neither affirm nor deny, what is it now? What's left? This place, this way, cannot be found within judging and comparing. And then, when we free ourselves of that, then, when necessary to judge, we can judge. When necessary to compare, we compare. But without being deceived by that. I've been reading the teachings of Musō Saseki, who is, I believe he lived in the 14th century after Dogen. And somebody asked a question, if there's no difference between worldly activities and practice, why is it that Dharma teachers of different schools urge their students to set aside all activities and cut off relations with all things? So as the Buddha said, go to a quiet, secluded place. So you might even see teachings that say, you know, renounce your friends, renounce your family, go to a place, because that's all just dust of the world. In Mahayana, you see these teachings. And Musō Saseki said, an old master said, in the Buddha Dharma, there are no fixed forms. What is important is responding to circumstances. He says, none of the Dharma gates used by masters have fixed forms. Zazen has a very clear instruction. Osho gave it to you on Friday, for those of you here for the retreat. And it has no fixed form. The instructions are to be able to engage it and then begin to learn over time how to meet the circumstances of the moments as they come and go. So Buddhism, since between the Buddha Dharma and secular affairs, Buddhism teaches there's no separation between Buddha Dharma and secular affairs. How could any master that supports the Buddha Dharma say that Buddhist practice is to be found outside of worldly activities. However, those who don't understand this principle view the activities of the world in an illusory and inverted way. In their compassion, Zen masters encourage such people to set aside all worldly concerns as a temporary expedient to help them relinquish their attachments. And so good masters teach in accordance with their students' capacities so they don't bind themselves to predetermined patterns. So it is helpful to go to a place that is quiet, right? That is uncomplicated. It's helpful to come here. That's why we exist here. That's why monasteries exist. It's helpful to sit in silence. It's helpful to come to Seishin. These are all helpful, expedient means to help us relinquish our attachments and work through all of our distractedness so that we can move more and more into the full, as Dhanarush would say, the full catastrophe of life. But even here, right, you're not leaving behind all your worldly concerns, right? You're on dish crew. You have a caretaking practice, right? Get to the Zendo on time. We have to still do things. And then he tells an interesting story about a monk named Devasarva, who was a monk of the Buddhas, and he came from sort of wealth and luxury, and he loved fine things. He loved fine clothes and ornaments and furnishings. He loved those. And so then he heard the Buddha talking about the monks shouldn't adorn themselves. And he's listening to this in horror and thinking, oh my God, I can't do this. He said, I was born into a wealthy household and lived in a mansion decorated with gold and silver inlay. My clothes were embroidered with beautiful threads. And even then I wasn't satisfied. How am I possibly going to be satisfied wearing coarse clothing and living in a rude dwelling? I can't do this. So he goes to the Buddha and he says, I'm sorry, I can't do this, right? I love my stuff. And so rather than the Buddha saying, okay, he called Ananda, his attendant, and said, Ananda, go to the palace and ask them to borrow fine clothes and fine furnishings and situate his room with all of those fine things. So Ananda did that. So they gussy up his room. He sleeps there. And he had such a wonderful night. His desires were all being fulfilled because he's in this place that felt so familiar and grounded and stable. And in the course of the night, he realized himself. He says, and he also flew through the air. So Ananda the next day was very puzzled, and he comes to the Buddha and he says, wait a minute. He says, you know, what's going on here? Why did you do this for this monk? And the Buddha said, there are people whose aspiration for the way grows through adorning their clothes and homes. It encourages their aspiration for the way. For such people, adornment is an aid to practice. And then there are other people whose aspiration for the way would diminish with ornamentation and fine clothes and houses. Such practitioners must be cautious about such things. Realization of the way and its fruits is entirely a matter of the practitioner's mind and has nothing to do with clothes or dwellings. We used to have a student in the temple when I was there who would very often come on Sunday mornings, do caretaking, and I'd see him in the bathroom on his hands and knees, cleaning toilets, scrubbing the floor. And then after we'd finished with the morning program, there would be a limousine waiting for him. And it would take him to the airport, and he would fly a private jet to some international meeting in Europe or Asia, one side, the other side, moving amidst an intermingling, a mind that is pliant, a self that is softening, relinquishing, that is not about being large or being small, is not about succeeding or failing, isn't depending on that. That's the problem. Right, the sense of self, with a sense of self, will depend on things to affirm that it is enough, that it is complete. Why does that never satisfy us? The Buddha said, because it cannot come from the outside. And so we see people who have enough for 100 planets, and it's not enough. To meet the self, this mind, this body, our thoughts, our emotions, skillfully. It's very important to be skillful. And so in teaching, with student and teacher, the teacher, part of the training is to be met skillfully by one's teacher and to see that happening all around them and then to learn how more and more skillfully to meet the needs of the student, which is going to be different than the next student, which is why what happens in face-to-face we don't talk about, because it's not for anybody else. It's specific. It's not because it's a secret thing. It's because it's specific to that person at that time, at that place, in that state, to meet the needs and present and present capacity. In a sense, a student as a Buddha has an immense capacity, but in this present moment, it's limited. Right? It's limited by virtue of my karma, my life, my practice, how developed, and so on. And so the student, the teacher is always trying to meet that present capacity and then a little bit more. Extend it. Push it. So the student doesn't become complacent within that sense of their present capacity, but isn't over-challenged so that they lose their trust. In an old sutra, it says, if teachings don't meet the student's present mind, then it may elicit fear and doubt, or irritation and anger. And so this sutra says that sutra is actually talking about a beginning bodhisattva, someone at the beginning of the bodhisattva path who's beginning to have some influence over other people. We might think of that in terms of, you know, students who are being given responsibilities to lead a dish crew or give training for a service position, are now directly having influence on giving instruction, trying to guide that student. And so meet the student's present mind. If we don't do that, they're going to have a negative reaction. Get to know their mental disposition. Offer what is being offered in stages and at the right time. So even the service positions work that way. Right? They're all important, but they have different levels of complexity. But we could also think about this in terms of being skillful with ourselves, and learning to discern more and more over time what we actually need, not just what we want. Because in the beginning, you know, a student has just started sitting, counting the breath. They come in and say, this isn't working for me. I need to work on a koan. They don't even know. They haven't even tried it yet. Or they've tried it and they find it difficult. So that must mean this is not working for me. I got to switch. It's like, no. Stay put. Stay steady. It's okay. But as time goes on, we're learning, we need to be learning how to be in more a guide for ourselves at the same time that we're studying with a teacher. And so the person who may be doing advanced koans comes in and says, I think I need to practice my breath for a while. I'm seeing more and more that I really need to strengthen my concentration. That's excellent. They're seeing, by virtue of their development, by virtue of the progress of their practice, that this shift, which is not a shift back, but just kind of a slight shift in a, you know, sideways or whatever, is helpful, is skillful, is meeting their present circumstance. Somebody who realizes that they really need to work on cultivating their compassion, they take responsibility for that. And so they start incorporating a metta practice. They start being more aware of their judging mind. There was a point early in my training where I would come in every morning. I was sitting monitor at that time. Everything was fine. Everybody was fine. People were just sitting, minding their business. And I would start judging people. By the end of this period, I was pissed off at everybody. Nobody was doing anything. I was so irritated. And I could see it logically and think, wait a minute, nothing's really happening here. And then I reflect on that, what's happening? What's going on? I tried to sort of understand it. And I couldn't really find anything that I could, you know, locate. And so I just thought, well, I just need to practice it. So I was very alert. And every time, you know, in successive mornings, as soon as that judging mind came up, I was alert. because I wasn't before, I was indulging it. That's why it kept building up to a crescendo. And so I was very alert and we're trying to just not indulge it. And over time, that impulse, that whole period, whatever that was, began to shift and just dissipate. So we begin to learn how to help ourselves. Right? We've been trying to do that forever, right? By getting more or holding on tighter or avoiding. But now we're really helping ourselves. It's like working with anger. You know, there, Zazen has no fixed form. And so when the emotion of anger arises, the first thing is, am I seeing it? Am I allowing myself to actually make contact? I'm angry. Just that acknowledgement is important. So I'm not trying to put a cloak of equanimity or calmness or it's not okay to be angry. I'm angry, right? And if it's not too strong, I try and just let it go. Just drop it, redirect my attention back to the breath, give the energy there. And if it's not very strong, it may dissipate. But it is strong, right? And so it keeps persisting and persisting. And so then I shift my attention from the breath to just that emotion. Because there it is. That's the reality. And so I'm learning how to move in my element in the presence of that strong afflictive emotion. Because if I don't do that, I'm not going to find my way and I'm not going to find the place. And so I develop the capacity to sit there without denying it or ignoring it, but without telling a story. It's just heat. It's just strength. Whatever the sensation is, I don't add meaning to it. It's just sensation. And because I'm not feeding it, it will begin to dissipate. Or maybe I do that, but it persists, and it persists. And so maybe now I direct my attention to a metta practice. And I cultivate compassion more in a more deliberate way, generative way. Not just letting go, ceasing from harm, but actually sort of providing the medicine. These are all completely valid practices. How do you know what to do at each moment? Well, in the beginning, you stay with your core practice. And then seek counsel, ask a teacher. But then begin to learn how to work with your mind in different ways, to move in your element. And in that way, nothing is ignored. Rather, things, you develop a developing kind of mastery, not in any final way, but in the sense of more and more confidence about how to work with the universe that we call you. And as we're developing that capacity, then it gives us much greater capacity to work with other universes on two legs, particularly tough ones, right? Because we see basically the same stuff happening. Different format, different presentation, different levels of power and influence, for sure. But it's not that different. Moving in our element, we attain the way. We see that this life, so in a way, being born and living at such a difficult time as ours, we could look at it as just a massive heartbreak. And it is. It is. First and foremost, because it doesn't have to be like this, right? And not because there's some cosmic plan that's off the rails, but because we don't have to do this. We don't have to live this way, right? We create a hell realm. And creating a hell realm, usually we can't keep it to ourselves. And so it's painful. In a way, the more we see it, the more painful it becomes. But we have a practice to not dwell, to not indulge in that pain, because who's that helping? And so to shift and say, wow, this is really a time in which serving is needed. This is really the time in which being a benefit in whatever way is possible is needed. When the qualities that we all possess of patience and generosity and clarity of mind and courage and perseverance are needed. Well, You have some of those, I have some of those, so how can we put them to good use? So those of you who came here for the weekend, I hope it was helpful in some way, moving you a little bit further along your path, whatever direction that is. You know our address, so you know how to come back. We have a seat waiting for you. If you'd like to come back. Whatever the path is, if it is going to be transformative, it has to have some quality of a path, which means there are steps that need to be taken, right? We are doing stuff every day. Being on a path means doing within that path. So, thank you for being here for this weekend. I'll end with a few words. I came to the mountain seeking the way. I came to the mountain so that I might not leave anything behind. Asked to be cook, I declined, having spent many years in the kitchen. But I came to the mountain seeking the way, and so I cooked for the Sangha. And then I began to see, while I knew a little about preparing food, I knew nothing of how to make a meal.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.